Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 14, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's subject is the False Claims Act. Who is responsible? Who is the responsible government official? My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are very fortunate to have with us Mr. Mark B. Sweet, who is a partner at Wiley Ryan, as well as Ms. Brandon J. Moss, who is an associate at Wiley Ryan. Both are members of their white-collar practice and handle many FCA cases. After our speakers give their remarks today, we'll move to an audience Q&A. So please keep in mind what questions you have for this subject, for any of the cases that they discuss, or for one of our or both of our speakers as well. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. Mark, I believe the floor is yours to begin.
Thanks, Wes, and thanks for everybody for joining in. We're going to talk today about a case that is pending before the Supreme Court involving the False Claims Act. The case is scheduled for oral argument next week, so we thought this week would be a good opportunity to discuss it. It involves a few parties. On one side is a government prime contractor and subcontractor. The prime contractor is Parsons Corporation, and the subcontractor was the Cochise Consultancy. And on the other side, of course, is the United States government and a relator, a QTAM relator named Billy Joe Hunt. So we're going to talk through how the case came about, what it implicates, both the narrow questions and some of the broader implications that could be triggered by the way the court rules. So I'm going to start off by giving you guys a little bit of background about the False Claims Act and some of the statutory provisions that are at issue. And then Brandon's going to give a little bit of background on how the facts of the case unfolded and how we got to where we are. And then we'll talk about how the court might rule and what that might implicate, both specifically in the questions presented to it and where it could go beyond that. I think Brendan and I both are really interested in this case, not just for the issues that have been presented to the court, but really where else it could go, because as we've seen in some of the past False Claims Act litigation, once you present things to the Supreme Court, you never know what they're going to rule on and where they might take it. So a lot of interesting things could come out of this, and a lot of issues that we deal with every day could be affected. So with that intro, I'll get started. So the False Claims Act, as many of you know, is the government's primary tool for fighting fraud against the government. It imposes civil liability for a variety of fraudulent acts, including knowingly submitting false claims for payment to the government, knowingly making false statements or using false documents that are material to false claims, or knowingly concealing or improperly avoiding or reducing an obligation to pay money to the government. And what makes the statute unique is that a whistleblower, or a QTAM relator as it's called, can file a suit on behalf of the government. And the way this works is the relator would file a complaint in federal court under seal, which means it would not be known to the defendant. The complaint and any supporting materials would then be sent to the Department of Justice, either to Main Justice or a U.S. Attorney's Office. The government would then have an opportunity to investigate the allegations made in the complaint. Usually they do this by issuing a civil investigative demand or a subpoena for documents. They can take testimony, it can do interviews, all the normal ways that they would conduct an investigation. So the defendant in that case might have awareness that these issues are under investigation, but they would not have awareness that the complaint has been filed, and they would not have an opportunity to do discovery of their own. At the end of that investigative process, sometimes that can take a year, 2 years. It can take quite a long time. It's really up to the government and however long the court gives them on extensions of time to conduct their investigation. But however long they need, they usually get. And at the end of that process, the government chooses whether they want to intervene and take over the case or not. And if they choose not to intervene, then the QTAM relator can pursue the case in the name of the government. This means that the relator can litigate the case just like any private party would litigate a case. And any money that the relator recovers at the end goes to the government, with a percentage of that going to the relator personally, and the relator's attorneys getting attorney's fees. In these cases, a relator can get up to 30% of the total recovery. So it's quite a substantial amount and quite a good incentive for a relator to bring allegations. If the government intervenes, that's capped at 25%. If the government does not intervene, you can get up to the full 30%. Now, any False Claims Act case is subject to a statute of limitations provision under 31 U.S.C. 3731. And the way the statute is written is a little bit confusing. It's not the clearest wording, and that's probably why we're here today talking about this and why this case is before the Supreme Court. So there are two provisions in the statute of limitations for False Claims Act. The first one says a civil action under this statute may not be brought more than 6 years after the date on which the violation of the statute is committed. That's pretty straightforward. It's straight 6 years from the date of the violation. The second provision, which is the part that's at issue specifically in this case, says a civil action under the statute may not be brought more than 3 years after the date when facts material to the right of the action are known or reasonably should have been known by the official of the United States charged with responsibility to act in the circumstances, but in no event more than 10 years after the date on which the violation is committed. So breaking that down a minute, what that really means is, this is what they typically call the tolling provision of the False Claims Act. But what it means is if the government doesn't find out about the case immediately, you can have up to 3 years, whether it's the government or possibly the relator, up to 3 years from the date when the responsible government official knew or should have known of the material facts. So the reason this is often an issue, as with all fraud, there's a concern that the government may not find out about it for quite some time. It may be concealed. It may just not come to their attention. And so the statute builds in some time for them to learn of the issues, investigate, and decide whether the government wants to take action. Usually, the latter provision is pretty easy to satisfy. The government finds out, typically, in most of these cases, when the relator brings the matter to its attention, and usually that happens in the form of the sealed filing, the lawsuit. So if the lawsuit's been filed, and that's the first the government finds out about it, then the statute's satisfied. It's within 3 years that the complaint has been initiated. And this really works in the government's favor because you can then have up to 10 years under that provision of payments that you could potentially recover under the False Claims Act. So your damages, and in this case, the False Claims Act gives you three times the damages suffered by the government. The damages under False Claims Act can be really high as a result. And the problem that tends to arise, and I think the backdrop to all this case, is that these cases tend to move very slowly. And Brandon's going to talk about this Hunt case in particular and why it's moved so slowly. But in all False Claims Act cases, there's just no rush on the government to move. If the first they find out about it is when the relator files their complaint, then statute of limitations often isn't a consideration that they've got to worry about. And the courts usually don't put that much pressure on them to make a decision whether to intervene or not. So there's not much rush on the investigation. It takes time, of course, for subpoenas to be issued and for documents to be produced and witnesses to testify. So all of this can take a few years. And by the time the witnesses testify, it's often 5, 8, 10 years after the alleged fraud occurred. So, of course, memories start to fade and evidence starts to disappear. And that's really what I think could be at risk here in the Hunt case. So, Brandon, why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened in the Hunt case? It's a wild case. I will say, when I read it, it involves, as she's going to tell you, bribery, kickbacks, forgery. I think a blind guy even got tricked into signing a document. He didn't know what he was signing. And after all of that, someone even went to jail, and yet only lawyers could turn it into a case about the statute of limitations. So that's where we are.
Now, this is definitely one of the more compelling set of facts you'll ever hear, and it does make for good bedtime reading, and it's not surprising that the court would want to take something like this. I could easily see it ending up in a law book one day just because kids are going to want to read it. But in any event, as it's a statute of limitations case, the best way to start describing it is by timeline. And this one takes us back to 2006. Back then, Parsons, one of the two defendants, was a government contractor who performed numerous contracts for the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. Particular contract here was a munitions clearing contract known as the CMC contract. Basically, when the enemy would retreat or when they defeated enemies in Iraq, Afghanistan, this is the company they hired to go make sure there weren't any things left on the battlefield, bombs, IEDs, all those things. Make sure it's fine. Relator here, Billy Joe Hunt, worked for Parsons on the CMC contract. Parsons was awarded the possibility of doing a subcontract for the contract because they needed security for when they're clearing the munitions. So they bid out a subcontract, and they gave it to a company called Armor Group. Well, it turns out that, as Hunt alleges, the other defendant in this case, known as Cochise, was bribing an Army Corps of Engineering officer named Wayne Shaw to direct and directed Parsons employees, including himself, to basically give the contract to Cochise instead. Well, Parsons didn't do that. They gave the contract to the person they wanted to, at which point Wayne allegedly fraudulently drafted a rescission of that contract and then gave it to the person he wanted to give it to anyway. So eventually Cochise did succeed in getting the contract and provided Parsons with security services from February 2006 to September 2006. For what it's worth, Hunt alleges that Parsons immediately rebid the contract when Shaw left Iraq and gave it back to the Armor Group. Now, let's fast forward the story to November 30th, 2010. This is a little more than 4 years after the fraud concluded, if you assume the end of the fraud was the end of the subcontract. That's the day when FBI agents knocked on good old Relator Hunt's door to ask him about his role in another kickback scheme. And as part of that interview, Hunt told the agents about the scheme involving Parsons and Cochise and described it as a big rigging scheme and bribery scheme that resulted in the government being charged for security services at a grossly inflated rate that were not performed, and that the government was charged more than $1 million a month in additional charges, plus other fees for products that they didn't need to buy. Hunt was eventually charged for his role in the kickback scheme, which instigated the FBI knock and talk, and he spent 10 months in prison. Let's fast forward again. Now we're at November 27, 2013. This is 7 years after the alleged fraud concluded, and 2 years and 362 days after Hunt told the FBI about the alleged fraud.
So you're outside the normal statute of limitations, 6 year statute of limitations, and the only thing that's available at right is the longer tolling provision.
Yep, you're still inside 10 years. The only thing that can keep you alive here is the idea that the 3 years hasn't run yet based on telling the government. Hunt had just gotten out from prison, and he decides to file his QI-TAM complaint in the Northern District of Alabama. Eventually, after researching the case, investigating, the U.S. government decides to decline, and Hunt moved forward alone. The Northern District of Alabama threw out the case on statute of limitations issues. Hunt then appealed. Now note that the case would have been barred in circuits that have weighed in on applicability of subsection B2 to date. For example, the 4th, 10th, and 5th hold that a relator can't take advantage of B2, so the statute of limitations would have run in September 2012. On the other hand, the 3rd and the 9th, which do allow a relator to take advantage of B2, would also have barred it because they say that the 3 year is triggered by the relator's knowledge of the key facts because they're the ones standing in the shoes of the United States. But here, on appeal, the 11th Circuit decided to do something totally different. The 11th Circuit concluded that the relator could take advantage of B2, just like the 3rd and the 9th, but that the relator was not the official for purpose of triggering B2. They reasoned that 3731B's use of the phrase civil action under 3730 includes all types of FCA cases, government-initiated, relator-initiated in which the government joined, or relator-initiated in which the government declined. They said that nothing in 3731B2 says that the limitations period is unavailable. That makes sense from a statutory basis. But on appeal, the defendants looked at a Supreme Court decision called Graham County Soil and Water Conservation District versus United States, ex rel Wilson. There, the court said that the 6-year statute of limitations in Section B1 didn't apply on a retaliation claim under the False Claims Act, even though B1 applies to, quote unquote, a civil action under 3730, and the retaliation claims are authorized by 3730H. They said that the statutory language has meaning only in context, and the context suggested that a civil action under 3730 was ambiguous rather than clear. They interpreted it to not include retaliation claims based on the statutory context and the interpretive canons. They said that statute should be interpreted to avoid counterintuitive results. Congress legislates against the standard rule that the limitations period commences when the plaintiff has a complete and present cause of action. In other words, Congress has to go out of its way to change the state of the status quo. The key to that decision, of course, was the absurdity doctrine per the defendants. The ambiguous statute should be interpreted to prevent ambiguous results. In this case, it wouldn't make sense to interpret B2 as allowing the springing right of action, where in theory it's dead for a long time, but as soon as you tell the government, it springs back to life. The relator counters the argument, saying that there's plain meaning, the absurdity doctrine can't be invoked merely because the statute creates bad outcomes for a party. That's kind of the state of play right now.
Yeah, so those cases are interesting. The relators like to assert in these cases that they are one and the same with the government. And I think this Graham County case is a good example of situations where a court has read into the statute some daylight between the relator and the government. In other words, although the relator is bringing the case in the name of the government, they are not exactly the same. And so that's kind of what's at issue here. There's this now three-way split, which I guess is the appellate lawyer's dream. But this three-way split, you've got circuits going in three different directions on how to interpret this second provision in the False Claims Act statute of limitations. So there's sort of three ways the appellate courts have already come out on this that the Supreme Court could follow along with. First, it could go with the circuits that have said that the longer limitations period is available to a relator-based complaint, but only when the government intervenes. The logic here would be that, you know, there's no need for a tolling provision based on the government's awareness when the relator has firsthand knowledge of the fraud. We don't need the relator sitting on a case, kind of like Hunt did, going to jail and then coming out and thinking, you know what, maybe I should file a complaint about that.
Really making good use of that jail law library.
That's right. 6 years after the fact or 7 years after the fact, when he's known about it since day one, that's, you know, bad for policy. He's just sitting there letting the damages rack up, you know, while no one's aware of what's going on. The problem with that idea is that the statute of limitations provision in the False Claims Act doesn't really distinguish between government actions or relator actions. It just says a civil action under the statute, and that includes either one. And that includes situations where where a relator starts a case and the government investigates and decides not to intervene. So I think this idea has some logic, but it's got some problems, especially if you're just reading the text of the statute. The second way that the Supreme Court could go, which is how some of the other circuits have gone, is to say that the longer limitations period is available in all suits, regardless of whether the government intervenes. Again, the logic here is the flip of what I just discussed. Statute doesn't distinguish between cases where the government intervenes or doesn't intervene. And, you know, to counter these policy concerns about the relators sitting on their rights and waiting to file, people have correctly noted that the statute has plenty of other provisions in it to protect against that. There's what's known as a first-to-file bar. That prevents a relator from waiting too long, because if another QTAM relator files the same suit first, then the second to file is out of luck and can't proceed. There are also provisions that suggest you can't be a parasitic QTAM relator. In other words, if the allegations are publicly available, then you can't file a lawsuit based on what's publicly available. So That's another risk that any relator takes when they wait to file, that, you know, the information could become public. And if they wait too long, then they're not really bringing anything interesting or notable to the government's attention. The problem, though, with this provision is, or this interpretation is, you know, it doesn't really make sense to trigger the statute of limitations based on someone else's knowledge. So if the relator is the one proceeding, why should it matter when the government becomes aware of the facts material to the right of action? Shouldn't the relator's knowledge be the one that triggers the statute of limitations if the relator is the only one proceeding? And I think, you know, that makes some sense too.
Especially given the amount of time the government sometimes takes to investigate it after the case is brought in the first place.
That's right. That's right. And if the government has said that they're not really interested in the case, oftentimes they don't want to have to be the subject of a lot of discovery. And if the whole case is going to turn on, well, what was in the mind of a government official, that could be really burdensome and painful for the government to go through when they didn't really even want to be in the case in the first place. So, you know, it puts the government in an awkward position. It puts the parties in the awkward position of having to take discovery of a third party, or, you know, or you can debate whether they're a third party or a real party in interest, but someone who's not actively participating in the litigation. So that creates problems. So then you get to the third possible way to interpret this, which is that the longer limitations period is available in all suits, but the relator could be the, quote, responsible government official whose knowledge of the facts material to the suit would trigger the limitations period. In other words, the relator would have either 6 years to bring the suit or 3 years from the point the relator becomes aware of the action to bring the suit, if the government doesn't intervene. This has some logic too. The relator stands in the shoes of the government. He is suing, or she is suing, in the name of the government. And there are, you know, a lot of provisions that suggest that the two are one in the same. They're all on the same team. They recover together. So if, you know, if the relator is filling that capacity as the government official in that respect, charged with the responsibility to act in the circumstances, then in that case, he's filling that role and he is then subject to the same limitations. The problem is the language of the statute says, you know, uses this unique wording that it's when the official of the United States charged with responsibility to act in the circumstances becomes aware. And that's not language that appears anywhere else. So there are other provisions that tie the relator to the government and say they're working together, but none of them use this language calling that an official of the United States. So the weakness with this interpretation is really that this is the only time the statute specifically refers to an official of the United States. So to say that that's the relator, I think is a bit of a stretch just from a looking at the language. And then additionally,
sorry, really quickly, not to interrupt,
yeah,
but what are your thoughts on the fact that if you do identify the relator as the official of the United States, are you still going to need TUI subpoenas when you go after the government itself for things?
Yeah, there's all kinds of practical problems.
If you're equating them, then discovery is going to get really simple for defendants all of a sudden.
And you could, and you know, this case is about what happens if the government doesn't intervene, but if the Supreme Court were to say, yes, the relator is the official charged with mm-hmm. the responsibility to act, does that mean anytime the relator knows about something that starts the clock on
yep.
everybody, on the government too? Because you could imagine a situation where, you know, the relator becomes aware of it, doesn't tell anyone for 4 years, and suddenly that provision that the government's banked on for so many years is no longer available at all, depending on how they rule. So I think there's a lot of practical implications and problems really with deciding it this way. That's why I think it's unlikely that of all of these options that, you know, the court would go in that direction. But the district court did in this situation. They ruled that as an alternative basis for dismissing the case. So it's possible. It's out there. And certainly the defendants would like it. It would help shorten the time period for statute of limitations. It would simplify this in a lot of respects. When did the relator know? And how do you get to from 6 years from the statute, from the violation occurring? So it would simplify things quite a bit. So Supreme Court could really go in all of these directions. You know, any of these would have a direct impact on how long is available The narrow question, how long is available to bring a suit if the government chooses not to intervene? But, really the language they use could affect how long is available for both the government or the relator to bring a case. And then there are some other directions they could go. One of the things we learned from the Escobar case is that just because you present a narrow issue to the court doesn't mean that they necessarily are going to stick to that narrow issue. In the Escobar case, it was about, whether the question presented was whether there's a cognizable theory of liability for implied certifications. In other words, if your invoice to the government contains nothing in it that's false, but you're sort of impliedly certifying compliance with all the terms of the contract or all the regulations governing the program, is that a basis for saying that it was a false claim? And the court ruled on that issue, but then they went further and said, well, all of this is cabined by materiality. And they just started introducing this whole new element, really, to False Claims Act cases about, is the false statement material? That was something that really had not been vetted, briefed, argued much, but that was something the court, came in and decided on its own, and that has spawned a ton of new litigation. So, with that happening, we could really see a lot of the court going in a lot of directions here, and I think that's where Brandon and I are most interested, because this could affect a lot of different cases, even beyond this sort of narrow situation where the relator brings a case and the government doesn't intervene.
Yeah, for example, one of the things I think that they might be able to address, either advertently or inadvertently, is the constant question practitioners in this area have as to who is the responsible official of the United States who needs to have knowledge to start triggering this. Is it DOJ? Is it just the Attorney General and his designees? Or could it be a broader subset? Could it be a contracting officer or potentially the Inspector General? Anyway, there's been a great debate over this point in jurisprudence, and every defendant wants to say that the government knew about the fraud early on. And it kind of goes hand in hand recently with the government knowledge type materiality arguments, as Mark just referenced under Escobar. Of course, the chances are that Supreme Court will stay on the narrow track and just determine whether the official of the United States can or cannot be the relator. There's always a chance they could resolve once and for all exactly who the United States needs to know. How could this happen? Well, one of the arguments is that the relator can use B2, and if they can use it, it would increase discovery costs for the defendants, who have to use TUI requests to suss out when the relevant U.S. official actually became aware of key facts. Basically, they're arguing that, if it's based on when the government knows, then who is in the government who knows, it's going to cost more to do it, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, the counter-argument in the briefing is that it's not a problem because the scope of discovery would be limited to the Attorney General and his delegates, the fraud section attorneys, the assistant U.S. attorneys, et cetera, et cetera. Attorneys who basically have the authority to address FCA allegations and who open files when they know of such allegations. So that would be the sharp cutoff point.
And that's certainly what the government would prefer. They've advocated both in this brief that they filed in this case, as well as every other case that they have out there, that the responsible government official is the Department of Justice. And they're the ones charged under the statutes with bringing a False Claims Act case. They're the only ones in the government who can bring a False Claims Act case. And so they should be the only responsible government official. Nobody else in the government has that kind of authority.
Yeah. And if the Supreme Court agrees, there's a chance they might include language indicating that in their decision, which would answer the question. Or, if they disagree, they could try to shoot down the thought by saying that there are many others who could have the relevant knowledge. I mean, in this case in particular, given that it's the FBI here who's alleged to have the knowledge, it's unclear if it would be assumed that it would be relayed to the AUSA. I'm not quite sure what's going on, but it seems like something they might need to discuss.
Yeah, and if you look at the contracting officer's responsibilities under the FAR, it's very broad. It includes broad language like safeguarding the interests of the United States. Obviously, IGs are charged with rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse. So, they are an official of the United States charged with responsibility to act under the circumstances if they become aware of fraud.
And this is a big deal, especially for government contractors who, when they discover fraud, they have a duty to make a disclosure to their contracting officer and also to the inspector general. If they can say those things, automatically start the statute of limitations, they're going to be in a better spot.
Yeah. And what about, you know, a suspension debarment official? Mm-hmm. They have an obligation or a duty to take action when they become aware of fraud. What about, you know, agency counsel or even just the program chiefs, you know, the people who run the program? They obviously have their own obligations to take action when they need to. Some of the offices of general counsel have kind of mission statements online, as you can see, and a lot of them broadly worded. They talk about their role in rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse and protecting the interests of the United States. So, I mean, you could make the case that all of these people have that kind of responsibility. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the attorney general because, you know, and the other thing is the statute says, and the official charged with responsibility to act on the circumstance. It doesn't say the attorney general, even though it does say that in other parts of the statute. So Congress could have used that language again if they wanted to. They didn't here. I think this could, you know, depending on what the court says, and they're going to have to say something about who that responsible official is. They may be very precise in what they say, but they may not. They may be broader in just talking about it, and it could end up harming the government and, you know, helping defendants quite a bit if they have some broad language as to who is the responsible government official.
I will say this before moving it over to you to talk about other broader implications. I think it would be very ironic if the Supreme Court were to come back and say, basically anyone with responsibility to act, meaning a contracting official, et cetera,
yeah,
could be the person when Shaw, this bad apple, is the one who instigated the whole thing. He arguably had responsibility to act if he saw fraud or abuse. So it'd be very odd for them to come to that conclusion under this particular set of facts. But I wouldn't put it past people.
I do feel a little bad for Shaw. You know, this is a motion to
alleged.
Yeah, so he is dragged through the mud, absolutely. And I'm sure when the case got dismissed, he was like, thank goodness. You know, I can now say it was all, you know, a bunch of baloney and got dismissed immediately by the court and there's nothing to it. But now this has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so his name will forever live in the annals of law as the guy who did all these terrible misdeeds. And this case may never get a chance to even
poor
see
guy.
The courtroom.
Well, maybe poor. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's bad apple.
One of the things that I don't think Brendan touched on this, one of the things that came up in the case is that he apparently tricked another government official who was blind into signing a document that would have rescinded the contract and allowed the other contractor to take over. So, I mean, if the guy did it, that's pretty terrible. But this, the facts here could not be any more sensational. Anyway, another broad question that could be implicated here is, you know, what violation triggers the running of the statute of limitations? So, you know, if the court is looking for ways to curtail these cases and to, you know, is concerned about the due process implications of having these extremely long statute of limitations periods. And, you know, in this case, you're talking about, this is a good example, these allegations or this fraud allegedly occurred in 2006. It's now 2019, and we're still at a motion to dismiss phase. We haven't even gotten to discovery. By the time we start issuing document requests and having witnesses testify, it's going to be 13, 14, 15 years after the fact that people are supposed to remember exactly what happened. That's going to be hard to do. And I think as a defendant, you've got a real due process argument that this is, you know, unfair.
Yep, I agree. In fact, at least in this case, you have the actions leading to the fraud and the submissions pursuant to the fraud in the same period, more or less.
Yeah.
I could easily see a situation in which there's fraud and inducement of a contract. That's a 10-year contract. You have a 10-year statute of limitations on top of that for the payments pursuant to the contract. You file 10 years later. You go through all the rigmarole with productions and investigations, and you're not looking at trial until 25 so years later.
I mean, it's wild, but it's actually possible. I agree. Now, so if the court wanted to get into that and they're concerned about it, another thing they could do is to say, well, the violation, so the stat, and just to remind you guys, the way the statute is written is it's, you could bring the action, you know, up to 6 years after the date on which the violation occurs, or up to 10 years after the date on which the violation occurs, depending on which provision you're using. But the court could say, well, what is the violation? Is it, in like in this case, is it the fraud in the inducement, the fraud that occurs that leads to the award of the contract? Like here it was bid rigging and bribes and other gifts and gratuities that led to this improper award. Other cases, just plain false statements that are made in a proposal. But if is the violation that, you know, what induced the award? Or, as the courts typically do, say it's the violation, each violation occurs every time the government receives a new claim under that contract that was improperly awarded. And, you know, that, of course, stretches out the time period that's relevant longer and longer and longer. Every time you're submitting new claims for payment, you know, you're stringing out the limitations period. So the court could look at the word violation and say that, you know, this provision has to be curtailed at some point. And in this case, the violation occurred before the award. And so if you measure from the date of the violation, it's been more than 6 years and it's been more than 3 years since, you know, someone became aware of that. It's been now more than 10 years by the time someone files it. I don't know if that's going to save them here, but it's possible that the court could go down that road of figuring out what is the violation. The court could also start thinking about what are facts material to the claim. You know, this longer provision is based on when facts material to the right of action are known or reasonably should have been known by the government or by the official of the United States, as it's written. You know, what exactly constitutes facts material? Did the FBI have facts material? Did the contracting officer have facts material? So they could get into an explanation of what that is. And it may not be that they intend to rule on that basis, but just describing it, just expanding upon that could have a significant impact on statute of limitations cases in the future.
One thing we haven't touched on yet, which I thought was interesting, you know, you always see these opposing briefs and they don't have a lot in common, but both parties did agree on one thing here, and that's the Supreme Court had to take up this mantle to quash a practice called forum shopping.
Yeah.
In this unique situation, this case would have just dismissed in any other circuit that has taken up this question, except for, I guess, now the 11th Circuit. If this case were to have held the way it is with the three different splits, because of the broad venue provision of the False Claims Act, relators can almost bring cases anywhere. You better believe that there would be a lot of relators headed down to Florida, Alabama, et cetera, to file their cases, which, you know, in some cases, there's just no nexus between the defendant and that area, which can cause enormous expense. But just the concept of under the rule of law of something that would have been dead in any other case springing to life based on a legal construct, not the facts of the case, is just something that needs to be resolved.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of procedural issues here. There's some substantive implications. And it's no surprise that although on its face, I think it sounds like a narrow issue that the Supreme Court would want to take it up. And I think we'll all be really interested to see how narrowly they tailor the opinion, whether they get into some of these broader issues, and what impact this has on other cases that, you know, may not necessarily fit this fact pattern, but are, you know, heavily litigated between defendants and the government or defendants and a relator.
Yep. Agreed.
Yeah. So with that, we'll open it up for questions if there are any.
Before we get to an audience question, Mark and Brandon, are there any other subjects that you'd like to dive into or cover in more detail?
No, I don't think so. If you've got any questions, we're happy to answer them. If not, you know, we look forward to seeing the outcome, and hopefully we can do this again after the Supreme Court rules.
Absolutely. This has been one of the most thorough discussions we've had on a teleform prior to questions, so I would imagine, just like the audience, we're very grateful for the detail you went into and for going through the subject with us. Seeing no immediate questions from the audience, we're very grateful that you all joined us for this call. Mark and Brandon, any final thoughts for us?
No, but thank you so much for joining us. This is an important case. It'll be fascinating to see what happens.
Absolutely. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you both for the benefit of your very, very valuable time and expertise. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.